Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Let me start, as Trent tends to do, with a federal update on things that are happening in Washington, D.C. Last week, Congress arrived at a bipartisan agreement to transition states to the Families First Prevention Services Act, which you've heard about in previous meetings. This was a federal act which in some ways complicated California's ongoing efforts to reform its child welfare system through the continuum of care reform process. However, there are a couple components of the federal agreement that will ease our transition. One of those is that while funding for Title IV e-waiver counties, of which San Francisco is one, had originally been expected to come to an end at the end of this federal fiscal year, Congress has now agreed to provide two additional years of transition funding in federal fiscal year 2020, which starts on October 1st. Those counties will receive 90% of the amount that they had previously received, and in federal fiscal year 2021, they will receive 75% of the amount that they had negotiated to receive under their waiver. So it's a ramp down of funding rather than an abrupt end to funding, which is very helpful. There will also be $500 million in one-time flexible funding to help states with their transition, and there's no state match to that federal funding, so that was a welcome provision as well. Moving now to public charge, which is an issue that we've been talking about a lot over the last several months. Again, this is the new federal rule that goes into effect on October 15th that will broaden the number of public benefits that are considered when an immigrant is seeking to attain legal status here in the United States and can sort of count as a negative on their application for a green card. Again, cash benefits have always been subject to public charge, but under the new rule, CalFresh, Medi-Cal, and federal housing assistance will be also considered to be public charge. As you know, we've been doing a lot of engagement with the community around this, pushing out lots of information to our clients, partnering with other city agencies and community-based organizations and legal advocates to really get clear information out to the community, which is challenging on such a complicated and arcane subject that, quite frankly, is designed to sow fear and confusion in the community. However, just so that you know that we're doing our due diligence, we have printed posters and postcards that are being sent out to all of our non-citizen households. We have posters in our lobbies, posters that have gone out to health clinics, libraries, other public gathering places. We are also partnering with legal advocates to conduct a number of community stakeholder meetings at which we will be training both community providers and members of the public about what this rule really means. On the legal front, San Francisco and Santa Clara counties were the first to file a lawsuit against the new federal rule, and the state of California quickly followed. The San Francisco District Court on October 2nd will be hearing our request to stay implementation of the new rule. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that they will stay implementation, but we're also doing everything we can to get ready in the event that implementation moves forward on October 15th. The third federal update has to do with the SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as CalFresh here in California. There is another proposed federal rule change that would have the effect of restricting who is eligible for SNAP assistance. And again, it's sort of an arcane policy rule. It has to do with something called categorical eligibility. But in effect, what the rule does is takes away some of the flexibility that states currently have to allow families and households at a slightly higher income level to qualify for SNAP assistance when their expenses bring their gross income down. So in a high cost of housing market, for example, we are able to deduct families' housing cost and still allow them to qualify for CalFresh at that lower income level. This rule change would take that ability away. It would also compel us to reinstate an asset test for the CalFresh program, which in practice has the effect of meaning that families really have to spend down every last penny of their savings before they can qualify for food assistance. And so for many years now, we have not had an asset test in CalFresh. This rule change, if it goes through, would force us to reinstate that. Nationally, about 3 million people would be negatively impacted, meaning that they would lose their SNAP benefits. In California, our estimate is that approximately 350,000 households would lose assistance, and in San Francisco, the number is about 3,200 CalFresh households. In addition to that, there's an unfortunate ripple effect in that many children who receive free and reduced-priced lunch would be negatively impacted, because right now, if you receive CalFresh, you can be automatically qualified for free and reduced-priced lunch. This would undermine that effort as well. So again, we are working with the mayor's office and the city attorney to submit comments in opposition to this rule change, and we'll keep you updated as that conversation moves forward. I'll pause. Are there any questions on the federal updates before I move to the state? Okay. State-level updates. So the state legislature ended its legislative session in September. The governor has until October 13th to sign the hundreds of bills that are now on his desk. I want to just briefly highlight two that CWDA has been working to get passed. One is AB 944. This is a bill that we took a second run at this year that would allow indigent non-citizens who came to this country and were sponsored immigrants. Right now, if those individuals are on CalWORKs and they claim indigence, meaning they're no longer getting financial support from their sponsor, we can provide CalWORKs assistance to that family for 12 months. But after 12 months, they're no longer eligible. This bill would allow us to extend CalWORKs benefits for indigent non-citizens beyond the 12 months. So we're hopeful that the governor will sign that one. AB 1301 is a child welfare bill that, beginning on July 1st, would require child welfare agencies to compensate licensed private adoption agencies for the cost of supporting families through the process of adopting children and non-minor dependents. And so that is a bill that would have some funding attached to it, and again, we're hopeful that that one will be signed as well. Moving to the local level, on September 12th, Supervisor Stephanie hosted a hearing on food insecurity in San Francisco, with a particular focus on food insecurity among pregnant mothers and young children. So a number of city departments were called to present at the hearing about efforts underway to address food insecurity. We contributed lots of content to that presentation, talking about, of course, the CalFresh program, all of the home-delivered meal programs and food pantries in the city, and then also a new innovation that we're preparing to implement this fall, which is a partnership between the WIC program, Women, Infant, and Children Nutritional Supplement Program, and CalFresh. We know that many families are eligible for both programs, but there are a couple thousand families on WIC in San Francisco who are not enrolled in CalFresh. And so what we'll be doing is having a WIC benefit specialist on site at our buildings, helping to enroll pregnant mothers and mothers with young children into WIC at the same time that they're here to do business in CalFresh or Medi-Cal. And then conversely, that WIC specialist will also be trained to provide CalFresh application assistance back at the WIC offices. So we're very excited for that partnership and can perhaps do a fuller update once it launches. The other thing that is happening at the local level, you've probably seen a number of Chronicle articles recently about a recent analysis by the Department of Public Health. San Francisco has a new director of mental health reform, Dr. Anton Bland, who has decided to target a discrete population of homeless individuals who have either severe mental illness or substance abuse issues, or who are dually diagnosed with the two, and who are also high users of city services. There are about 4,000 such dually diagnosed homeless individuals in San Francisco, and the Department of Public Health has decided that it will in particular target 230 of those who are the highest users of city services, whether that's acute health care, ambulance services, people who are often picked up and taken to jail, unfortunately, the very tiny percentage of homeless individuals who consume a disproportionate share of the city's emergency response system. Those 230 will immediately begin receiving an enhanced form of care coordination, bringing together public health, human services, Department of Homelessness, law enforcement where warranted, to really create a comprehensive case management plan for those individuals and get them connected to both the housing and services that they need to stabilize their situation. So we will be partnering with the Department of Public Health on that initiative, primarily to ensure that those homeless individuals are connected to the public benefits that they are eligible for. Update on a couple of different communications items for the agency. At the end of August, we hosted a film screening at the Roxy Theater right here in the Mission of the HBO documentary film Foster, which was a compelling look into the complexities of the foster care system in Los Angeles County. It was a really fun event, about 150 HSA staff, community partners, resource families, former foster youth, and our own President Khan and his wife Vicky were in attendance at the screening. It was really an opportunity to bring staff and community partners together outside of their regular work routine to celebrate all of the work that they do, acknowledge the difficulty of the work, and honor the positive impact that they have on the lives of San Francisco's foster youth. So that was a great event. If you didn't make it to the screening, Foster is available on HBO, and I would highly recommend it. Heat events. So it's been hot, as you may have noticed. And there has been a lot of citywide coordination led by the Department of Emergency Management about how to make sure that we are reaching out to vulnerable populations, particularly the street population, making sure that they have cool places to go during extreme heat events, handing out water, pushing out information via our social media channels, and so forth. Our own Office of Communications here at HSA has been amplifying those messages, and our facilities team has been hard at work making sure that our buildings don't get overheated after earlier this summer one of our service centers had to close when our chiller system broke down due to extreme heat. So thankfully we have not had a reoccurrence of that. Okay, moving on now to some programmatic updates. In my division, the Economic Support and Self-Sufficiency Division, we are approaching the season of open enrollment for Covered California, which of course is the state's health exchange that was created under the Affordable Care Act. We now have nearly 4 million Californians enrolled in Medi-Cal as a result of the Affordable Care Act's Medi-Cal expansion. And from October 15th to January 15th, we will be helping to support open enrollment into Covered California as well. Additionally, on the horizon in Medi-Cal is an eligibility expansion. So taking place in January, in this year's state budget, the state legislature approved an expansion of Medi-Cal to 19 to 25-year-old young adults, regardless of immigration status, who will now be eligible for full-scope Medi-Cal. You might recall that a couple of years ago, minors under the age of 19, regardless of whether they were documented or not, gained access to Medi-Cal. This goes a step further now and extends Medi-Cal coverage up to the age of 25 for that population. Also in Medi-Cal, there was $30 million in state and federal funding provided in this year's budget to do increased outreach to increase Medi-Cal uptake. There was a lot of publicity around Medi-Cal when the Affordable Care Act rolled out in 2013. But now we're starting to see a slight downward trend statewide in Medi-Cal case rolls, and so we want to reinvigorate our outreach efforts and boost Medi-Cal enrollment. San Francisco will be applying for some of that funding, and we will let you know if we are successful in being awarded. On the CalWORKs front, the big news in CalWORKs is something called CalOR, the CalWORKs Outcome and Accountability Review. This is a new CQI process that's being implemented in all 58 counties for the CalWORKs program, where counties will really be required to gather much more robust performance data about their CalWORKs programs. I believe there are about 36 new performance measures that all counties will collect so that we can compare how those programs are performing across the state. The first step in that process is that we will need to be conducting a strategic planning process for the CalWORKs program and submitting that strategic plan to the state in July of 2020. So as that moves forward, I'm sure we'll be doing a presentation to this commission just to keep you all updated on the findings of our strategic review. In our CalWORKs housing support program, we have housed 416 clients through our rapid rehousing program. These are homeless CalWORKs families. And we just learned that we'll be getting a little bit more money this fiscal year than we had anticipated for that program, about $400,000 more than we had anticipated. So that means a number of additional families that we will be able to house this year. So that's great news. In CAP, our County Adult Assistance Programs, we have a grant increase going into effect on October 1st. It's a 13% increase meant to mirror the grant increase in CalWORKs. The top monthly grant will go from $520 to $588 a month in the CAP program. Additionally, we let you know a couple of months ago that CAP had launched an online portal to apply for CAP benefits, kind of bringing it into the 21st century along with our other programs. We're now receiving about 50 to 60 online applications a month for the CAP program, so that seems to be gaining some traction. And in Family and Children's Services, November is National Adoption Month. National Adoption Day is November 8th. And on that day, we plan to hold an Adoption Day event at which we will be finalizing 10 adoptions. So that should be a fun event, and we'll get the information out to all of you in case any of you would like to join. Additionally, the AB 636 self-improvement plan, submitted every few years by Family and Children's Services, has been submitted to the state. We're awaiting state feedback on that. And at the next commission meeting in October, FCS will be presenting on the SIP to this commission. Those are the end of my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have, commissioners.
What was the date of National Adoption Day?
November 8th.
Are there any questions from members of the commission? You did a great job. So, item 5 is presentation of our employee of the month. This month, we're fortunate enough to have 15 members of the Human Service Agency family being acknowledged as part of the racial equity work group members that are members that are many are here. And I did contact the chair and the two co-chairs to thank them for their help. Rather, being fiscally responsible to the Human Service Agency, we chose not to purchase 15 clocks because that would use up our budget for the whole year. However, as I was sitting here, I was thinking to myself, we do have certificates for everyone. If anybody would like a clock, okay, we have, well, one person directly sitting in the center that wants a clock. If anybody else would like them, I will personally pay for the clocks so that you guys can take a clock, a trophy home and put it on your mantle or wherever. We didn't have enough time to order them all, nor enough money. So, what I am going to do is take a moment to mention everybody's name, and please excuse my pronunciation. So the chairs are Valor Adithi, Rosa Ortiz, Dan Kelly from the Planning Unit, Kelly Bryant from DOS, Alexis Cobbins from Families Rising, Laura Duenes from Welfare to Work Services, Cassandra James from San Francisco Benefits Net, Rhonda Johnson from Family and Children's Services, Van Long from Family and Children's Services, Dr. Roxanne Manning from Adult Assistance Programs, Brenda McGregor, In-Home Supportive Services, Phyllis Pettis from Adult Protective Services, Priscilla Prado from San Francisco Benefits Net, Paulo Salta from the Office of Aging, and Armando Zapote from Office of Early Care and Education. Thank you for all of your energy and effort, and I'm going to pass these out.
Congratulations to all of you. I know that you were honored last month at the Aging and Adult Services Commission, and it is absolutely appropriate that you be recognized here today because this has really been an agency-wide effort. All of the members of the GARE work group lent their time and their personal experience, their passion, and their intelligence to advancing racial equity work at HSA. And in the process of doing so, they really had to make themselves vulnerable and be willing to come forward and engage in difficult conversations. So thank you so much for having had the strength and the willingness to do that. I'd like to especially recognize Laura, Cassandra, Rhonda, and Phyllis, who took on a greater leadership role in this effort by joining the 2019 GARE training cohort and bringing their learnings back to the agency. I also want to particularly recognize Aditi and Rosie. These two in particular really poured their hearts and souls into this work group over the last 18 months. They did it in addition to their regular full-time jobs, and it was a very significant commitment of their time. You brought real dedication, grace, intentionality, and leadership to this effort. And on behalf of the executive team of the agency, I really want to just personally thank you for having stepped up to do that. You both went above and beyond, and under your leadership, the work group's process and resulting report is really going to be, I think, a model for the city family. We have had a number of discussions about that report already at the executive leadership table. We know that it is only the first step in work that is going to be ongoing work for this agency, but it's a wonderful first step. It's a very comprehensive report with a number of recommendations that we have already committed to moving forward this fiscal year. The success of our racial equity efforts, however, really hinges on each of us to be champions in this work. And so I want to thank all of you for having stepped up and shown us the way in that, and call on all members of the agency to follow their lead. Thank you again.
We've worked together a lot. A little bit here. But we just wanted to say that collaboration has really been central to the success of this project. We've been working for 18, 20 months now on some variation of this racial equity work. And we know that the folks who've really engaged so far in the process are going to be really instrumental in moving it forward, and we're looking forward to more people coming on board with the process. But we specifically just wanted to thank the executive leadership team for really identifying this as a priority, investing time and energy in this group, and engaging with the process throughout the entire year and a half's worth of work that we've put in. We wanted to thank the GR cohort, Human Rights Commission, and our training cohort members, because we shared a lot of expertise across agency lines, and I think we can already see this effort shaping up to be a really exciting collaborative process citywide. Of course, the work group members who committed a lot of time and energy coming to meetings and really engaging head first with really complex problems of race and racism and inequity in the workplace. And then who else is on our list? I think that instrumentally, the staff, our labor partners who came forward and participated in focus groups and interviews, they laid a lot of personal and oftentimes painful experiences on the line for us to mine as a learning experience, and understanding what our strengths are as an agency and what gaps we still have to fill. And we really, really wouldn't have been able to do it without that kind of vulnerability. So to build on what Aditi said, we're just very grateful for the opportunity to lead this work at the agency. We're especially thankful for the commitment, the support, and the genuine interest that we encountered along the way throughout our research and planning efforts. And more than anything, we want to see the agency, we're excited to see the agency drive this work, and we look forward to making HSA a happier and more equitable workplace for everyone.
Again, thank you very much. Moving on to item 6. No, but you can go out that way and just walk that way. Well, they'll let you, have the guard. The guard away. Cleared out.
Liz is just, I'm Susie Smith, Deputy Director for Policy and Planning, and Liz is just getting the PowerPoint set up. And what we're going to do, this is a great segue, because what we're using this opportunity now is to actually educate and share the information in more detail about what the city and particularly HSA is doing around addressing and identifying racial disparities and promoting racial equity at the agency. And so we wanted to just use this as an opportunity to not only honor the members of the racial work group, but also to be able to share some of our work and what the year and a half long culmination of research and analysis and focus groups resulted in, so you can understand our plan moving forward. Connected. And you should, have a copy of the PowerPoint in front of you, so you can follow along as well. Great. Thank you. Okay, so just by way of background, over the last couple years, the city as a whole, do you have a question? Do you need one? Okay. You got it? Okay. Over the last few years, the city of San Francisco as a whole has started to prioritize racial equity, and I'm sure that it is no surprise to any member of the commission or the agency or the public that racial inequities pervade every aspect of well-being, whether it's employment, housing, criminal justice, that racial inequities are prevalent throughout our society. And as a way to begin to recognize the role, the unique role that government has had historically in actually exacerbating racial inequities, the San Francisco Human Rights Commission partnered beginning in 2016 with the Government Alliance on Racial Equity, otherwise known as GAIR. And GAIR is actually a national network of state and local governments that are working specifically on uncovering, identifying, and combating racism within government. So the way that the GAIR process works in the partnership with the Human Rights Commission is that there are staff representatives from agencies across the city and county of San Francisco that participate in a year-long cohort of training, capacity building, and research to understand what's going on in their own departments and to be able to develop the kinds of plan that we're presenting today in terms of combating racial disparities. In addition, racial equity is in a really big priority of this mayor, and Mayor London Breed issued an executive directive on racial equity in the city's workforce in September of 2018, so about a year ago. And that executive directive affirms San Francisco's commitment to a diverse and inclusive workplace where all employees are treated with fairness, dignity, and respect. And so in the executive order, the mayor identified the Department of Human Resources to follow through on this commitment and to look specifically at the city's workforce as a whole. HSA's journey in beginning this work started in 2018, where we decided as an executive team that we wanted staff to participate in this training, get exposed to the tools, and begin to apply the frameworks here to HSA. And so Adithi and Rosie, who were just honored as the co-chairs of the racial equity work group, participated in that training and really got some in-depth exposure to the tools. And they initiated a strategic planning process over a year and a half that was guided and led by the men and women that were just honored as part of the racial work group. So the culmination of that work is a report called Advancing Racial Equity at the San Francisco Human Services Agency, looking specifically at opportunities in hiring, promotion, and organizational culture, which was just released earlier this month, Labor Day, right after Labor Day. And so we have an executive summary of that as well as a full report and the findings that we will share with you all if you haven't already gotten a copy of it. But I'm going to present some findings from that. Many of you might be familiar with this particular photo, but this is just to sort of set forth, what do we mean by racial equity? What's the framework that we're using as we discuss racial equity? And the goal is that race does not ultimately predict a person's success. So all the disparities that I mentioned, whether it's employment, housing, criminal justice, currently, we have disparities across all of those domains, and the goal of this work is really to close those disparities so that your race is not a predictor of how well you do in life. And what this little slide depicts is that it's not about giving everyone the same, right? It's about customizing people's, what we provide according to people's needs, and that we start off at different spots on the playing field. So here it's showing we all come in with different inherent abilities, and we come to this work with different historical discrimination and disadvantage. And so here are sort of the equities. We're giving everyone the same, but you know, the person who's really down, far down, can't see the game because they need more in order to be lifted up to that equal level. And so it's just a way, one tool, there's other kinds of depictions, but it's just a way I think that can help clarify what we mean when we look at the difference between equality and equity. So as I mentioned, Mayor Breed, her directive really started looking at internal about the workforce and how we are doing as a city regarding the workforce. And we too at HSA decided to first look internally in terms of our own workforce and how we're doing around different domains of racial equity. Successful organizations recognize the need to have a workforce that actually reflects the people that they serve, so that the people that are providing service can relate to, can better serve, and help the clients. And so when we look at our own data and we say, what is the composition of our staff and how does that reflect or not reflect our clients, we actually do pretty well on, as a whole. As you can see from the slide here, we have a diverse staff. We have about 45% API among our staff, and we have about 41% of our clients are API. When we look at other domains, African American, we have 15% that are African American among our staff, and we serve about 14% African American among our 175,000 clients. And so it's pretty equal, 15% and 14% for Latino, respectively. So when we look as a whole, we're actually doing pretty well. But when we look at other domains and break it down by the hierarchy, we're not doing as well, which we'll come to. And so really feel that in order to best carry out our mission, we need to make sure that we are diverse at all levels of our organization. So if we look at the initial data and we think, well, we're not actually doing that badly, our staff seem to reflect the diversity of our clients, why should we care? Why is this a particular challenge? And it's a particular challenge right now in the city's history because we are facing unprecedented gentrification and housing affordability crisis that has resulted from the tech boom but has been sort of growing over time. And when we look at the inequality in terms of wages and the bifurcation of the city in terms of wealth, we're just seeing that the cost of living is outpacing the people that, the native San Franciscans that can live here. And we see it particularly with the African American population, which has now dwindled to only 5% of the city's residents. And so if we want to actually maintain the diversity that we currently have in our workforce, we need to be extremely proactive in our approach to recruiting, maintaining, and growing our staff. So now we're kind of moving into what our goals are and what the specific strategies are for those goals. So the first goal is that we employ a diverse staff who reflect the racial and ethnic backgrounds of all of our clients across all of our departments and programs. So the strategies in order to meet that goal, we've got three that we're working on initially, and under each of these strategies, we actually have a whole list of specific actions that are in the report that I'm not going to go into all the details, but it's really in this area about performing active recruitment in underrepresented communities of color, so building relationships with academic institutions and building relationships with community-based organizations that primarily serve people of color. It's about enhancing our clarity and accessibility in the hiring process. Our hiring process is really complicated. It's hard really for anyone to navigate, and I think that if you don't have mentors or contacts already within city government that can walk you through the process, it can be particularly hard. I will say personally, I came to HSA after years in the nonprofit sector, and I reached out to friends that were in the city already to say, like, what classification am I even qualified for? How do I find out about the jobs? And so I think that kind of, I knew people in the city that could help walk through the complicated civil service-driven processes, and that helped me personally. And not everyone has that opportunity. And so us being very proactive about building relationships with institutions, looking at not just sort of elite private institutions, but looking at all, you know, public institutions and looking at affinity groups of color and building those proactive relationships to be able to recruit and have a pipeline of diverse applicants is one of the first steps. Another important piece is to use data and to really analyze our hiring process to understand, are there disparities in any step of our process and how do we use data to inform our practice and improve our practices? Oops, sorry. So the next major domain is around leadership development and promotion. So here, when we look at our current conditions, here's when we start to see more disparities. So at this chart, what it's showing is what the racial and ethnic breakdown is by level within the agency. And so we see, again, agency-wide, we have about 42% Asian Pacific Islander. But then as you move up in terms of the hierarchy of the agency and go to non-manager, supervisor, and manager, that goes to practically half. For the API population. On the other side of the coin, when you look at the white population, we're at about 21% agency-wide, but then when you look at managerial level or deputy director, executive director, it's much higher at 46%. And so this is really one of the key areas and problems that we wanted to address is how do we diversify and grow leadership within our own ranks, because we have it. We have a diverse staff when we look down the chain, but not so much as we go up the food chain. So why does this matter? I mean, why should we be concerned? And it's important because as you have leaders of color, obviously that can help mentor and promote other staff within an organization, that there is a natural affinity. And when staff see and our clients see that leadership is diverse, it matters. It matters not just symbolically, but it matters in terms of the kind of service people can provide. And so we're looking at how do we create a more supportive culture around promotion and equity? How do we look at the infrastructure for employees of color to advance professionally? We have a lot of skill development opportunities. Are people of color taking advantage of those opportunities in equal amounts as white employees? We don't have great data to track that, so one of the recommendations is to actually have a learning management system that can see who's really taking advantages of these opportunities for staff development and who's not. Things like mentorship programs, we've had some in the past, kind of rebuilding mentorship programs. And then, again, taking advantage of sort of understanding from a data perspective who takes advantage of these opportunities and who doesn't. So in this area, we wanted to employ our goal, leadership development and promotion, is to employ a diverse staff who reflect the racial and ethnic background of clients across all levels of HSA's hierarchy. And I already mentioned some of the specific actions that we're looking at, but it's really encouraging learning at every level of the organization and thinking about how career development aligns to professional growth, helping people with professional development plans and help them map out if I'm at this point of the agency and if I'm an eligibility worker, what are the next steps? If I'm a supervisor, what are the next steps? How do I, you know, work across and up the organization? And some those career maps are not always evident. It's not even just if you're an 1823 is the next step in 1825. It's not always vertical like that. And so making those more transparent. The next domain is around organizational culture. And organizational culture is sort of a broad term. But when we think about organizational culture, we're talking about not just why we do our work, but how we do it and how we feel about doing it. What's the sort of, do I feel respected when I come into the organization? Is that the culture is shaped by formal and informal norms that govern our behavior? And so here it's actually interesting because we had a lot of feedback from we do all staff surveys every couple years. And we found there were a lot of challenges in terms of people's perception of whether they felt valued and heard. And people of color in the reports felt less valued and in the self reports than white people. And so it's kind of taking a look at some of this area of culture and what are some of the steps we can take to address those. So I think actually, I mean, one of the first steps is the work that we're doing here and coming to the commission over the last year and a half, deciding to dedicate internal resources to get the GARE training, to do the staff focus groups. We had focus groups with over 70 members of staff throughout HSA. We had stakeholder interviews as part of this research process. We engaged our union partners and spoke to them. We did a study of the 2905, the eligibility worker class, to see, in doing an in-depth case study of the eligibility worker class, were there any disparities that came up in when we took a deeper dive. And we did a lit review. So all of this work was sort of our beginning steps at looking at our internal culture and getting under the hood a bit. So our goal in this area is to cultivate a workplace environment in which HSA employees of all race and ethnic backgrounds feel respected, valued, and supported to carry out our agency's mission. A few of the strategies that we have for advancing this goal is to demonstrate leadership's commitment to promoting equity and a culture of equity here at HSA, to foster staff's capacity to start operationalizing equity in their own professional practice. And what does that mean if I'm a hiring manager? What does that mean if I work on budgets? And what does that really mean if I'm a line, you know, direct service worker? And then sustaining an explicit and ongoing commitment to advancing racial equity. And part of that, frankly, is holding ourselves accountable and having clear action steps and saying, did we achieve those action steps? And having operationalizing the work that's in this plan to a real clear work plan that says, here's what I'm going to achieve in the next few years, and here's our roadmap. And as Noelle mentioned earlier, this is sort of the beginning of a long process. This doesn't get solved in a year or two. It's really an ongoing effort. So the last two slides specify those actions that we are committed to. As we released the report, it was sort of our first public way of saying racial equity is something that is very important to this agency and an area where we know we need to work on. And so we identified a number of actions that we could take in the next year or so to commit ourselves to the work. So the first action is to create a new Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the agency, and to have a manager level position to oversee the work and to work in partnership with engaging staff who are committed to different pieces of the work plan. The second is to issue public resolutions declaring HSA's commitment to racial equity. So we will be back later on to get a resolution here at this commission as a statement of support for the work. The third is to adopt racial equity as a core HSA value. We're engaged in a rebranding process and a large communications effort to kind of look at our value statements and our mission, and our part of that will be to make sure that racial equity is explicitly a core value within the organization. Next is to conduct demographic staffing analysis. As you've seen, we've done analysis at the agency level and then at the level of position within the agency. But the next step is to actually look by program to see how well our staff represent the people that they serve in each program, because it varies, the demographics vary according to the program. And so that would be kind of the next delve in terms of a demographic analysis. And I already mentioned the importance of cultivating recruiting relationships with educational institutions and professional associations, primarily serving people of color. I mean, that's something that we'll start, but that's going to be a sustained and continued effort that we will do, and HR will lead. And then this last slide goes over the next set of commitments, which is to develop and advertise job opportunities in venues serving job seekers of color. We partner, as you all know, with community-based organizations to deliver services and to extend our reach within the community. And many of those community-based organizations have leaders that would be great to be at HSA. And so part of it is also using our networks that our staff have, that our program staff have, that leadership has, to promote opportunities to work at HSA. The next is to begin training on core competency modeling. And that's really to identify what are the core competencies for each job classification, so that we can ensure as we're evaluating that people are really clear to know this is what's expected of me, and these are the core competencies of the job, and so when they're evaluated that it is fair and that assessments are transparent. The next one is to begin racial equity trainings for staff, all staff, so leadership through the entire agency, and we're beginning those efforts as well. There's already an executive order for any hiring manager to participate in anti-bias training, and so that's underway already. And then finally, this effort really needs to be informed by good data. And so our HR director, Luena, has been really an instrumental leadership around looking at our data along with other HR leaders across the city and with our Department of Human Resources to kind of develop the metrics that enable us to better analyze disparities. That was a lot of information. But hopefully it's a good peek into the beginning of our work on this journey, and I welcome, here's the contact information for Rosie and Adithi, and a way that we're using communication to be able to have people submit information or questions, and we have an inbox, and that's listed. So I welcome any questions, concerns, thoughts.
I certainly applaud all your efforts for racial equality and for advancing people of different faiths and different colors. But it seems to me that the bottom line needs to be the person who can do the job the best. Isn't that what we're about?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that one of the things we're trying to get at is that part of doing the job best is being able to relate to your clients and being able to mentor and grow staff as a leader when you're managing people. So our presumption is that having staff that reflect the people we serve actually provides better service. That is part of an ability to do your job well, is to actually be able to connect, whether it's language or cultural competency. And so we do think it's actually important in as a human services agency that's part of doing your job well, is bringing those sensitivities and the personal experience that can inform the delivery of the service.
Thank you.
Mr. President, oh, sorry.
Not a question, just observation. Under action plans, will the creation of the new office mm-hmm. then take the responsibility for managing all of these other 19 points?
Exactly. So, and there's...
Who will then do it for we?
What's that? Yeah, so, and in fact, I didn't even get into all the action points that are in the plan. It's a very ambitious plan. And so the first thing that the manager will do is really look at the plan and prioritize, and also figure out the best way to engage staff at different levels in implementing the plan. And so absolutely, this is sort of the first document the new manager will read, and then working to operationalize that over time.
And then number five is my other concern, the cultivating of recruiting relationships. That work, I'm assuming, also will be headed by this new office?
Well, that will be working in partnership with HR. And so, I mean, HR is really the leaders around recruitment. HR also needs to partner with program staff, as I mentioned, that have connections to the community that can help share job opportunities. But those developing, cultivating those relationships will be in partnership with HR.
Yeah, Commissioner, I would just add that really the DEI manager will lead this work and provide leadership and coordination, but we're going to really need active participation from staff from all across the agency. So that person will help us shape our agenda and drive it forward, but of course will not be solely responsible for the outcomes of the plan. I also wanted to mention, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that position for the DEI manager is currently posted.
Is it out yet?
Yeah. It
great.
Is.
Yes.
Thank you. So if you have any candidates who you think would be a good fit for that position, please encourage them to apply.
Others? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. No problem whatsoever. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Robert Walsh, HSA's Director of Facilities and Operations, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Let me do a quick recap of what we're doing and why, and then hit me with any questions that you might have. I'm here today requesting authorization to pay closing costs of $50,000 and receive and transfer the deed and title to the real property located at 538 Holloway Avenue and all improvements therein in exchange for city's forgiveness of loans to the seller, Larkin Street Youth Services, in the amount of $1,030,913, which were facilitated by the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development, MOHCD. In addition to MOHCD, this agreement is being facilitated by the City of San Francisco Attorney's Office and the City's Department of Real Estate. As for the use of the property, it is used to provide rapid housing support services to approximately 20 homeless families per year. And feel free to hit me with questions. President Kahn.
Being that there are other departments, they must take a close look at this.
Absolutely.
The real estate looks at it, and people give their vote of confidence in doing this well before now.
Yes, and so we are actively working with them, and when I say them, I mean the Department of Real Estate, MOHCD, and the City Attorney's Office, and they're actually asking that we get permission from the Human Services Commission, and that's just the next step in the process. If y'all are in approval on this, then I can go to the next step, which is to execute the appraisals and get authorization from the Board of Supervisors.
Well, I guess my concern is that when they come up with $50,000,
mm-hmm.
and you haven't even had it appraised yet?
It was appraised in 2015, but in order for me to do the newest appraisal, I need approval to spend the money on the appraisal. So that's actually not the cost of the property, and I'm glad you. So it's just the closing costs, and it's actually a not to exceed amount. I think the costs are more likely to come in around $30,000 to $35,000, but we just wanted to cover ourselves in case we do need to spend a little bit more. I don't know if I would use the word negotiable, but it's a not to exceed amount. So it should be less than $50,000. But what basically where I got that $50,000 number is working with MOHCD, the Department of Real Estate, and the city's attorney's office to understand what is all included in the closing costs, which is the appraisal, legal fees, and like transfer of the deed and other things.
Does anyone even care to?
Absolutely. In a typical real estate deal, if I am, say, I'm purchasing a home or a building, absolutely you can negotiate the closing costs. The simple reason why HSA would be covering the closing costs is because the folks who own it, Larkin Street Youth Services, they're not really selling it to us. We're currently renting the property from them, and MOHCD gave them the loans, which is a little over $1 million. And so in exchange for forgiveness of the loans, then the city would be taking on the property as its property.
So the city will own the property.
Exactly. And it's basically MOHCD provided the $1 million or so in loans originally, and Larkin would then transfer the property to us, and so we don't need to owe ourselves the $1 million, basically. The reason why we're doing this, why we're transferring it from Larkin Street Youth Services to HSA, is that it's actually Hamilton Family Services that is operating the facility. So Larkin no longer has the contract to provide the rapid supportive housing services that happen within the home. It is definitely a confusing arrangement, for sure.
My concern is that I hate to see us spending money that may not need to be spent unless somebody is looking at the figure and negotiating the price.
Absolutely.
Commissioners, the transaction, the actual real estate transaction, is something that we will be doing with the help of the real estate department, and we'll be reliant on them to get the best deal on fees. What Ari is bringing you today is really just a request to cover the ultimate costs that we come up with in that process. And as he said, the city has made a loan and is now taking... It is proposing to take possession of this property for forgiving the loan. So we will end up with the property at 538 Holloway. And the item before you today is simply a request to cover the transaction costs, which, as I said, will be worked through with the real estate department, who does this as a matter of course.
And
yeah, and I think that is a question that is not always answered in exactly the same way. In this case, as Ari said, the program that is being run in that building is actually an HSA program. And so we have been working with the agencies that have granted the loan and the city attorney's office and real estate on the transfer. This building will come onto our inventory, right? Exactly. So there are a small number of buildings on the HSA and inventory, this building being the largest among them. And we have responsibility for oversight of those buildings and maintenance of those buildings. And so this particular property will join those several others as a building that is on the HSA inventory. It's an HSA program that will run out of that building, and Ari's team will have to pay attention to it and make sure it continues to run.
So. Well, I think my concern is that we're not just purchasing a piece of property. We're purchasing a property to deal with forgiveness of loan. And that changes things as far as I'm concerned. Whoever even approves the loan.
So the various loans were actually approved and provided by MOHCD, the Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. And this was between 2003 and 2008. So it's, and just to touch on the aspect of closing costs in itself, what we would be paying for are the direct costs. So we're paying for the exact cost of the appraisal, the exact cost of the closing, the exact cost of the legal fees. And you're right, in most cases it is absolutely negotiable. In this case, the real estate department are the ones who are initiating all of those services. And so we're paying that cost and it's not inflated.
You're just accepting the responsibility of paying the closing.
Exactly. It's the legal transfer of it, like transferring the deed and the title. There's a lot of legalities that go into that.
Well, because it's the real estate department, they have their own attorneys. I'm sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's dotted. But when it's presented like this to us here, it just gives me a little bit of concern.
Certainly.
Not that it's wrong.
It's also, I think, important to realize that this is
this is
an acquisition by the city, and as I said, it's going on to the inventory of the HSA, but it becomes a city asset, and the costs that are incurred in the closing are city general fund costs, and it's the same general fund that is bearing those costs as it would be if it were being paid by the real estate department. So there's not a difference in those dollars. They are funded by city general funds. Well, as I said, in this instance, it is coming to HSA for the use of HSA. I think that in this instance, though, it doesn't really matter. The city is acquiring the property, and the closing costs are going to be city general fund dollars. Whether they are paid by a check from the real estate department or by the HSA.
I think Dan's point, Commissioner, is that this is not the point Dan is making is a good one, which is that this is not a typical real estate transaction where you have two parties, a seller and a purchaser, who are negotiating. In this case, the seller and the purchaser are the city, and they're one and the same from a legal standpoint and from a budgetary standpoint. And so where the costs land on the ledger is somewhat immaterial from the city's perspective. It is also not anomalous, as Dan said, for city departments to hold within their own budgets relatively small facilities-related costs associated with the buildings where their services are delivered. Larger scale real estate transactions, those costs probably would not be laid on the doorstep of an individual city department. They would be handled at a higher level by the mayor's budget office. But something of a relatively nominal nature like this is quite often budgeted within the department.
Yeah, I mean, Noelle has said it well. We have, you know, contemplated buying properties, and when the amounts of money have been large, we go through a process working this through with the mayor's budget office and with the real estate department, and we consider the use of capital monies and monies that can't be capitalized. This is a much smaller and simpler transaction, and as a result, you know, in talking this through, some city agency needed to pick up the costs of closing. And it was fine with us, and it made sense to everyone else that we would do it because the building was coming to our inventory.
But the only concern is that we're getting the best deal possible.
Sure.
We're signing off on spending the city.
Sure. And in working this through, Ari will be working in close cooperation with the real estate department, and that's their job, is to get us the best job.
Are there any other questions?
What was the 2010 appraisal? When was the?
It was done in 2015, and they appraised it at $1.1 million. So, with inflation and things like that, you could probably add 5 or 6% onto that amount. So it is worth a little bit more than the amount of the loan. And just to say it, I mean, we plan to continue using this house in its current role to provide services to folks who are out of the house, out of a home.
Okay. Is there a second?
Thank you.
I second.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Hi, my name is Karina Zhang, and I'm a program analyst with Family and Children Services. I'm here respectfully requesting your approval to modify the grant agreement with Safe and Sound, which is formerly the San Francisco Child Abuse Prevention Center, for the period of July 1st, 2019 through June 30th, 2022, for the additional amount of $300,000 plus a 10% contingency of $219,510, for a total grant amount not to exceed $2,414,611. And the purpose of this grant is to educate the public about child abuse and child abuse reporting requirements, and to provide intervention services for families at risk of abuse and or neglect, including the commercially sexually exploited children and young adults. The funding for this modification will specifically serve the intervention portion of the services, and this modification will allow Safe and Sound to increase capacity to provide case management services from 80 to 100 families, and group services from 40 to 80 families. As a result, the total number of unduplicated parents or caregivers served will be increased from 120 to 150. Moreover, this additional funding for these grants is provided by a local general fund designated by the Board of Supervisors as an add-back. And every year, Safe and Sound serves over 1,200 parents and children and 800 families in their various capacities and programs. 92% of these families are low income, and 20% are homeless or insecurely housed. Using the protective factor questionnaire as the pre and post evaluation tool, Safe and Sound is able to demonstrate that 90% of the families engaged in services for more than a year show improvements in protective factors and reduced rate of child maltreatment. And 70% of the families engaged in group services for more than 6 months will show improvement in social connections with other parents or families. Without sufficient funding, these child abuse prevention and intervention programs will not be able to sustain, and families in need of these services will be at increased risk of getting into unsafe situations that would require child protective services involvement. So if you have any other questions about this modification, I also have here with me Jenny Perlman. She's the Associate Director of Strategic Partnership and Policy from Safe and Sound. And we will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I just noted that much of the modification has to do, or at least half, with salary. Is this an addition of a person coming on staff or different requirements?
I will have Jenny answer that question.
It is not an additional staff person, but it allows us to reallocate our resources to better serve our clients.
Okay. Aye.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Item C and item D are lost in love.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Jeff Nagai. I'm a program support analyst with FCS. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll try. Maybe I'll try to project a little bit better. I'm here to request the commission's authorization to modify the existing grant agreement for Seneca Family of Agencies to provide family evaluations for applicant foster care families. The commission initially approved Seneca to assist the county to provide family evaluations for conversion families who chose to complete the resource family approval process in 2018. The grantee was initially contracted with two other community-based organizations. The grantee was approved for funding to complete additional evaluations in February of 2019 when the third organization was unable to provide services. Seneca's been an excellent partner in the resource family approval process for conversion families and played a key role in helping the county clear a backlog of assessments for other applicant families needing an evaluation as part of their approval process. Seneca has accepted 100% of assignments made by the county, and have been very flexible around working with applicant families outside of the geographic area they originally agreed to service. San Francisco has also seen an increase in demand for family evaluations for applicant families, and we view Seneca as the appropriate partner to fill the increase in need. This modification allows the county to address that increase with 60 additional assignments for Seneca. If you have any questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Irina Kadantseva. I'm a program analyst with Family and Children Services. I'm here today to see your authorization to modify an existing contract with National Council on Crime and Delinquency for the period of July 1st, 2019 to June 30th, 2020 to expand an on-site training and coaching of safety organized practice with to include domestic violence component. This training will be offered to Family and Children Services staff, supervisors, and managers. Recent critical incidents involving domestic violence have increased the need for skill building to improve child welfare practice in the area of assessment, case, and safety planning. Intimate partner violence is a commonly occurring problem for the families that FCS serves. And the traditional approaches to helping families address this problem have not been very successful. This often results in a cycle of violence for families, repeat referrals, and system entries for children. As a system, FCS has been challenged to engage with families and develop lasting safety when a pattern of intimate partner violence is involved, and FCS has experienced a couple of high-profile situations with tragic outcomes for families. To address this issue, all case-carrying protective service workers, supervisors, and managers will participate in mandatory training offered by the National Council on Crime and Delinquency. Training learning objectives include knowledge acquisition, safety-based principles, and specialized approaches designed to support supervisors and support survivors and engage perpetrators involved in an intimate partner violence. National Council on Crime and Delinquency has partnered with Family and Children's Services Program for many years in providing reporting services, technical assistance, as well as training. They have consistently met their annual contract objectives and outcomes throughout the duration of our partnership. I'm happy to answer any questions or concerns, and I thank you for your consideration.
Is this the first time that we've done something about domestic violence?
We do have additional trainings for domestic violence separately, but not in the context of SOP.
So this is to expand it, expand the training, expand the service.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Expand the training and expand the service. Is that what you're saying? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Because Trent isn't here, we're not going to do the closed session today. In Phil Arnold's honor.
Commissioners, I believe that today we were hoping to adjourn with a moment of silence in honor of Phil Arnold, who...
Monday. First of all, there was not only an outpouring of love and emotion, but of people. There was an overflow crowd. And I'm so pleased that Phil's essence was captured by the program. All the speakers, including his family members, described perfect. I realize that no one's perfect, but Phil came as close to being perfect as anyone I've ever known. And his approach to life and its problems and its solutions was perfect and touched so many people in so many different areas. Among other things, Phil was acting director of the zoo, and he presided, I think, during his long and fruitful career over all kinds of zoos successfully. I am saddened that we've lost Phil, but I am so grateful that we, especially here at the Department of Human Services, were privileged to know him, to work with him, and to have the benefit of all of his knowledge and compassion. And I'm happy to move that we adjourn this meeting in the memory of Phil Arnold.
Second.
I would request that we send a note to his family that the commission has adjourned our meeting.
Will do. And I'll include a copy of the minutes.
Yep.